Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Hello, and welcome to the China Program podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. My name is Anders Hovey, and I am a senior research fellow at the Institute. And today we'll be talking about China's nuclear energy situation and prospects with Philip Andrews Speed, who is also a senior research fellow with the China Program at the OIES. Philip just published a paper entitled Nuclear Power in China, Its Role in National Energy Policy, which is available on our website. Philip, welcome to the podcast. It's good to be speaking with you today.
Thank you. Great to be back.
Before we start, let's introduce a bit of background, because China's nuclear sector gets a lot less attention than renewables and coal. With an installed capacity of 56 gigawatts, China has the world's third largest fleet of civilian nuclear reactors, and its ambitious expansion program will give it the largest fleet by 2030. In 2021, nuclear power provided roughly 4.8% of China's electricity supply. The country has made great progress catching up with the most advanced developments in other countries, notably with Generation 3 nuclear. That refers to a class of reactors starting in the 1990s with higher efficiency, passive nuclear safety systems, and standardized designs, as well as with high-temperature gas-cooled reactors. These new technologies could allow Chinese companies to become the world's dominant vendors of nuclear reactors in the future. Let's just set the stage by asking, how important is nuclear power in China, and what's its role in carbon neutrality?
Well, as you've just said, Anders, it provides 4.8% of electricity supply. But I think more interestingly, it provides 25% of non-hydro, low-carbon electricity. So nuclear is significant for China in really four aspects. First is energy security. It is a form of energy that is produced mainly within China. The technology is now mainly Chinese. Some, but not all, of the uranium comes from China. The uranium has to be imported. It's significant in terms of climate change mitigation. But also, I think, as you've hinted at, industrial and technology policy. They've indigenized most of the technologies, so it's part of this China wanting to be an advanced technology country, and there is ambition to export this technology.
You mentioned that it's important for carbon neutrality. There's a huge range of forecasts for nuclear capacity in the future, and I suppose output as well. Do you want to comment on that?
Yes, I mean, they have about 25 gigawatts of new capacity under construction, another 50 odd gigawatts that planned, and many, many more proposed. So, you know, the total capacity could easily reach 100 gigawatts by 2030, which would give it the largest fleet in the world. And it could even be more if some of the more ambitious projections are achieved.
Now, you note that China's nuclear capacity could almost double by 2030, based on the China Nuclear Energy Association's expectations that China could complete 10 gigawatts per year of nuclear capacity. Now, we know in other fields of infrastructure or manufacturing scale-up, China has a speed advantage on these things. Do we know anything about how long it takes to build a reactor from start of construction in China, given that that's just one of the biggest obstacles to nuclear in other countries, 15, 20-year construction timelines?
Well, the track record in the last 10 or 15 years is that most of the reactors have taken between 5 and 7 years from start of construction to commissioning and connection to the grid. But it should be recognized that as in the West, the first of a kind often takes longer. So the first Westinghouse AP1000 took 8 to 9 years, but still that's a lot less than some of the plants in the West. With respect to costs, we've got no details on costs, but clearly just the scale of the program means that costs along the supply chain will be less. The companies, the state-owned companies, get low interest loans. They have preferential tariffs and preferential dispatch most of the time. But interestingly, at times of relatively low demand of electricity and overcapacity, the nuclear plants have been following load rather than base load.
Now, after the 2011 tsunami caused a meltdown in the Fukushima reactor in Japan, China slowed its nuclear build-out. And now that it's really accelerated again in the last couple of years, what can we say about how safe China's reactors are?
Well, according to official information, there have been no incidents above levels 1 and 2 on the International Nuclear and Radiological Event Scale. Now, level 1 is a minor operational anomaly. Level 2 is a significant failure, but of no significant serious consequences, maybe minor exposure of a worker or member of the public to radiation. Level 3 is a serious incident, and of course, Fukushima Daiichi accident was level 7. So it's been pretty good to date, but I think behind the numbers, there are two issues. One, the human factor. Secondly, transparency. Now, a number of formal and informal sources indicate that the main causes of these incidents is what we call the human factor. Working practices, incomplete written procedures and documents, poor verbal communications, issues with training and qualification. And it appears that safety culture is a key concern. And behind this lies this rapid expansion of the capacity. So there appears to be a real problem hiring and training technical staff to the sufficient level. So some of the workers are underqualified or overworked, and this is a cause of some of the incidents. In addition, there is the political and social culture that discourages junior and middle level staff from highlighting problems. So there appear to be problems there, but there's not a lot of detail on this. The second issue is transparency, and there was a very good example in 2021 at the Taishan plant in southern China, where there were some damaged fuel rods, and the amount of information coming out was mixed. The regulator changed what should be the ceilings for local radiation. The Chinese and the French and the Americans were all involved for different reasons, and it was very difficult to find out exactly what was going on.
Now, how about the public perception of nuclear power in China and public engagement on the topic of nuclear power? I know that you just said that transparency is an issue. Is there engagement between the public and the government and the state-owned power companies when reactors are being proposed and constructed?
Public opinion is generally positive and has been for some time, despite the Fukushima Daiichi accident. The public likes stable supply, cheaper electricity, low carbon electricity. This is all good stuff. And there also is a relatively high level of trust in the central government. However, as might be expected, the level of support tends to decline close to sites for new nuclear power plants. Also, looking forward, we may find that opposition to new power plants becomes stronger when they start to build plants inland, because all nuclear power plants in China today are on the coast. So if there is an accident, pollution goes into the sea. After the Fukushima accident, the government banned any construction of plants inland. That ban is still in place, but this might be lifted, and therefore the risks of pollution to inland fresh water supplies would be an issue to be considered.
Where inland are we talking about?
Oh, probably almost every province has plans, but along the Yangtze and Yellow Rivers, etc., etc. In the past, there was very little engagement with the public by the nuclear power companies before constructing a plant. However, the nuclear safety law of 2017 obliged companies and local governments to consult all relevant stakeholders, including the public, on nuclear safety matters. And this might include questionnaires, hearings, discussions, symposiums, etc., etc. And it seems now that companies and local governments actually work very closely together and hold public meetings with all communities within a 30-kilometer radius of a proposed site. So there's that openness, prior to the construction. To what extent it's a two-way conversation is not clear. But I think coming back to my previous point, once the plant is operating, it's not clear that there is so much transparency. So we say, as you would see in France with the local information organizations, whereby there are regular meetings between the local community and the operator. I don't think that exists in China.
Now, let's turn a little bit to talk about the technology capacity of Chinese companies, which you already mentioned in the paper, has come a long ways in not only in conventional reactors, but also in more experimental reactor future technologies for nuclear energy. What can you tell us about that in terms of the technology? And as a second part to the question, does this imply that Chinese companies will be going abroad to build nuclear power stations in other countries, both countries that have nuclear reactors as well as countries that are in the developing world with no nuclear reactors?
In general terms, Chinese companies and research institutes are pretty advanced in many technologies relating to nuclear power. China has designed and built its own Generation 3 reactor, the Hualong 1, which is based almost entirely on indigenous components. Now, Generation 3 implies that it is more efficient and much safer than the early Generation 2 reactors that dominate the global fleets today. Notable are the passive safety systems that require no active intervention by operators to shut down the plant safely. China is also working on a wide range of other technologies, for example, small modular reactors using conventional water-cooled technologies, including marine transportable reactors. None of these are operating yet, so we don't know what capacity they will be. And then there are Generation 4 reactors. These use completely different technologies. In most cases, the science of these technologies was proven decades ago, but they have not yet been commercialized. They're also working on spent fuel reprocessing, which will reduce their dependence on uranium imports. And of course, like other countries, they're working on nuclear fusion. Now, when it comes to building abroad, they have two Hualong reactors that have recently come online in Pakistan. They're involved in the United Kingdom's Hinkley Point C reactor with EDF of France, purely as an investor. Now, Chinese companies have many other agreements around the world, but no other plants are under construction at the moment for a variety of reasons. In Europe, we've seen some pushback against having a Chinese investors in nuclear power plants. Secondly, I think these companies are fully occupied at home building out China's own nuclear power capacity. They don't have any spare capacity to send people and equipment overseas. And also, unlike Russia, there's no sign that the China's government is going to give strong financial support for the export of China's nuclear technology, with the exception of Pakistan.
Now, on the technology field, I think it's important to at least touch on the point of the timelines for new technologies, which sometimes can be quite far away, even though they're quite promising. What about gas-cooled reactors or even thorium? Are these decades away or a decade away from commercialization scale-up?
Well, China already has two operating high-temperature gas-cooled reactors. They are operating, I think they're dispatching electricity, or they will this year, if not next year. But that's taken a long time to build. They are relatively small. They're not making a significant contribution. Other technologies such as thorium-based molten salt reactors, fast neutron reactors, I think China, as in other countries, this is a long, many years before the first ones are actually connected to the grid, let alone producing significant amounts of electricity.
A lot of people in Beijing would be astonished to learn that there's an experimental gas-cooled reactor in the city's outskirts. What are the uncertainties and risks around the government's ambitious plans for nuclear power?
Well, I identified four things to sort of keep an eye on. And the first is pretty obvious, which is if there is a serious nuclear accident, either in China, in Asia, or maybe anywhere in the world, that could change public opinion, could trigger policy and safety reviews. And this might not stop, but it could again slow down China's nuclear power expansion. Another thing to look out for is how fast the national electricity market develops. And if renewable electricity becomes, continues to grow and is dispatched preferentially, can nuclear power be competitive at times of surplus supply? A carbon price would obviously help. So I think that this is an uncertainty as to how the power market and the carbon market will evolve. Thirdly, a severe economic decoupling could constrain the supply of uranium. But of course, most of this uranium doesn't come from Western countries. And so that may not be an issue. But, if there is severe tensions, then there could be some attempt to stop uranium going to China. But then it's an issue of how rapidly China can operationalize and scale up its reprocessing capacity. And finally, coming back to a point I've made earlier, is can China recruit and train a sufficiently skilled workforce to construct and operate these plants safely and securely? Because what I'm hearing is they're overstretched already. They're going to double and then double and then double the capacity. Can they really keep the workforce coming?
That's interesting. You didn't include cost on that list, especially the cost versus other low carbon technologies.
Yes, we don't know enough about the cost, but the fee, as you scale up, the costs come down. What you have to watch is quality of the supply chains, an issue that was suffered in South Korea. But that links to the whole issue of competitiveness and selling into the power market. Yes.
On the uncertainties and risks, do you see any risk around the issue of standardized designs, which is, of course, a key measure for reducing costs and increasing the speed of the build out, but also can lead to simultaneous outages when there's a problem, as has happened in Japan as well as currently in France?
Yeah, I mean, we're still seeing a number of different designs, but I think the number of designs that are being built will reduce as they become more reliant on their own technologies. So you're not importing a combination of Canadian, Russian, American, and French and Japanese technologies. They'll be focusing on a small number, at least when it comes to Generation 3, a small number of mainly indigenous technologies.
Well, that's all the time we have for today. Thank you, Philip, for joining us and discussing these insights. You can find the full paper on the OAES website, along with other content from the China program. Please remember to subscribe to the podcast if you'd like to receive more such content, and we look forward to joining you again next time.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as our original research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our energy transition, gas, oil, electricity, or China research programs, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.